Good morning to our first guest, Tom Rowe. How are you?
Morning, Mitchell. Great to be back on the program again.
Nice to see you. Let's start with the federal election campaign, because that was called on Thursday. So this is my first opportunity to speak to the listeners since the campaign has been called. And we're saying that there's three main contenders at the moment across the Geelong region. They are Richard Marles, Libby Coker and Sarah Henderson, and maybe Murray Angus if he is in fact the Liberal candidate for Corio at a distant fourth. So those are the three main players. How do you think it's going so far?
Well, I think three main players, but only two contenders, because Richard Marles is a shoo-in, quite frankly. So that just leaves one contest between Sarah Henderson and Libby Coker. I listened with some interest to your interviews last Tuesday or Monday.
Yeah, down in Colac on Tuesday, yep.
Yes. Sarah is like a jack-in-the-box. She's everywhere fighting for her political life. I understand that completely. I empathise very strongly. I know how much she's tried and the effort that she's put in and how keen she is to stay on. So she's everywhere and all things for all people at the moment. I just think too much and a very mixed, confused message out there, but she's certainly fighting and trying very hard. Libby, I also listened very carefully to her words, and I just find it boring. I don't know what she really stands for. Yes, there's the Labor Party talk and their messaging in a more broader federal national sense, but where are her messages for Corangamite and a plan for this region? Now, I think both fall into this trap. Sarah's promising the world, the kitchen sink and everything is in between. Libby, I don't know what she's promising at the moment or what she's hoping to deliver, but from both of them, I don't see a proper thought-through theme or strategy for the people that they represent in Corangamite, and that's what I think is missing from both of their campaigns.
Yeah, it's a fair point. It would be good to have a first principles discussion, wouldn't it? But from what I can see, that is an issue with the Labor Party, because they're trying to be sort of sensibly between the Greens and the Liberal Party and advocating for a progressive Australia, but just not too progressive. Like a friend of mine who's involved in Young Labour put one of those Facebook profile pictures up with the party message, and it said, "I'm voting Labour because they're fighting for climate change." But the Greens are fighting even more for climate change action, because they say 100% renewable energy by the end of the 2020s decade, and Labour's only saying 50%. So I think Labour's trying to carve out that sort of centre ground, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. That's the main fight for them, and the more they can claim with that centre ground, the much more likely they're going to win, and win with a reasonable majority to work with in government, which is, I think, the broad expectation. But anything can happen. I've been wrong beforehand. I was pretty wrong in the way the swing ran against the Libs in the state election last year in Victoria.
Not many people forecast that.
No, I was one of them. I didn't forecast it. So a surprise there, and equally there could be a surprise here. I was thinking it was going to be a really hard race for the Libs. I'm also sure now, I think it's going to be a bit closer than I gave them credit for, but we'll see. Victoria's a huge problem for them. Queensland's a very different story, and New South Wales, again, I don't get those stats nearly so much as I do Victoria, but I think Victoria is a very tough race for them indeed.
Incidentally, this looks like the United Australia Party candidate now coming through. He's got a bright yellow tie and a bright yellow hat, so that's great. Now, moving on to, I suppose, the contest of Corio, Richard Marles doesn't really have to try. I mean, if you want to assess his performance, he's not really being pushed because he doesn't have a viable challenger at this point. The Liberals haven't really started the campaign for Murray Angus, and so far there hasn't been, you know, a second party that is likely to come. Maybe it's the United Australia Party. We'll find out.
Indeed, but it's not just the candidates, Mitchell. You've just got to look at the extent of the primary vote advantage that Richard has, and how you pair that back to a point which makes that seat contestable is just too big a ask. So he's a shoo-in, but it can't and doesn't serve the people of Corio and the north of the Geelong, north of Geelong well. They all suffer as a result, it goes back to Northern Arc and all the other initiatives that should be in play and in train for the north, and we just don't see the level of focus or delivery, more importantly, from our political leaders. Yes, there's talk and there's an effort, there's a try. You know, Councillor Anthony Aitken is certainly out there talking to it. He appears on the front page of the Addy. I've got some criticism coming up, which we'll talk to in respect to the northern and western growth areas, which have recently been approved by framework plans by council. But the words are all out there. When it comes to the delivery, it's far from wanting, and much more needs to be done in terms of delivery. delivering real outcomes for the North.
And Councillor Kylie Grizzlebeck's put in the paper today her top five priorities for the North, and unsurprisingly, number one is the Northern Arc. We'll be speaking to John Aaron about that, but surely it's got to come down to the federal and state levels of government as to why they've decided not to fund this project.
Well, they don't fund it because they're safe Labor seats at the end of the day. So why spend a limited pool of capital trying to buy votes in that area when they don't need to, and the main contest is in the marginal seats? And this is the problem with politics throughout the country and also at a state level. It's not right, and best interests of community are not well served.
And in the meantime, Sarah and Libby are going head-to-head with our money, almost seeing who can exhaust the credit card limit the fastest. I mean, we've had that announcement yesterday from Sarah, two 50-metre pools. One is outdoors, the one on the Ballerine is outdoors, but the one on Torquay, that is indoors. And apparently the funding for Torquay is contingent on it being a 50-metre pool, in that if the council or the shire down there says, no, we want it to be 25, the funding doesn't flow.
Well, it's a bit of a trap then, and you can play those cards and think, well, there's a chance that council won't step up and the money doesn't need to be spent. So I don't know how genuine the actual promise is. Now, the other thing, talking about the credit card, Mitchell, importantly, I think most people don't understand this. There is only so much money for Victoria. So every cent that gets promised, whether it's on, you know, Fast Rail and a $2 billion circle around that, or pools for Torquay or the north of the Bellarine, what Corangamite gets, someone else has to pay the price for in Victoria, because the Commonwealth Grants Commission looks through all of these promises and budgetary provisions and says, well done, Victoria, you've had a great, you know, handout of pork to buy some votes. It's now going to come off your GST take. And this is what happens, and this is why this graph that I've shown you previously, very hard to show on radio, of course, Mitchell, just shows Victoria and New South Wales sliding well below what we call equal per capita distributions. Nothing changes this. The Commonwealth Grants Commission looks straight through the promises. If someone's being given a handout, unless it's a road of national significance, it just gets carved out of our GST take. So there's no more money. So what Corangamite gets, Corio misses out on, or some other part of Victoria misses out on. And people just don't understand this. There is no bonus for Victoria.
And the Fast Rail, you have to be a bit sceptical about that. I saw some signs out and about yesterday for Sarah Henderson's Fast Rail, and it said, I think, $2.4 billion for Fast Rail, and it said delivered. Well, it hasn't quite been delivered yet, because they don't have enough detail about, for example, where is it going to stop, what's it going to look like, what rolling stock is it going to use, etc., etc.
I think I drove in from Bowen Heads this morning and saw five of her, or six of her signs up on the roads and various people's houses. I think I saw one of Libby. So Sarah's presence throughout the electorate is phenomenal. But yes, those statements of Fast Rail delivered as a whole series of boxes with ticks in them. It's political optics, I think, and, you know, borderline deceptive. I think if you have a look at the budget papers, and I've tried to look and peel through the budgetary papers, it's not such an easy task. I don't know whether you've ever tried, Mitchell.
No, it's
this particular bit of chunk of money is in something called the population area or population growth area. I just couldn't find it. But I understand that the vast majority of this $2 billion allocation comes in 4 or 5 years down the track, and then beyond that as well. So we've got to go through this election, we've got to go through another election before we start seeing the real money. Yes, there'll be some money for a bit of planning, but of course this needs to be matched by the state, so there's $4 billion required, and of course everybody in the state, and I think anybody who has any real idea on Fast Rail delivery, will say $4 billion is only barely scratching the surface. It's more likely $10 billion by the time you're done, between $75 and $100 million per kilometre. You can see the way the numbers add up. So there's a huge chunk of money that's still required to be funded. It's unfunded substantially at the moment, so I don't see how they get there with $4 billion. So delivered is a big, big statement to make.
Absolutely. We better get on to some local government things. Just on the way through, I'll mention our candidates forums here. You spoke in the candidates forum for Ballerine, I think, back
in
the day.
I have indeed, yes, Mitchell.
So you know how it all works. We've got ones coming up for Corio and Corangamite. The Corio one is on the 29th of April, and the Corangamite is on the 30th of April. So that'll be very exciting. We've already got some tickets, and they're walking out the door very, very quickly. Lots of people are interested. So if you want to register your spot, go on to the Pulse website, 947thepulse.com/ask. And if you can't attend in person, you can submit questions there as well, and we'll read them out on the day. Now, local government issues. Well, let's just start by talking about this north and west land allocation first.
Yeah, so I touched on a bit earlier this morning, Mitchell. Council 3 weeks ago approved to go on exhibition what we call the Northern and Western Growth Area Framework Plans. I've been particularly critical with Council going out with these plans for exhibition because it doesn't include some sort of value capture tax. Essentially, by allowing this land to move into a more intensive urban use, predominantly residential, but also some commercial as well as active and passive open spaces for community support and amenity, you provide a massive windfall uplift to the land values in these areas. Now, we're talking about circa 40,000 home sites through the two growth areas, allowing a total population increase of about 120,000 people. In my view, this will add about or create about $2 billion of windfall gain to the lucky landowners and speculators and rent seekers that will start coming to the people like me to be cashed out over time. The problem with this type of planning and not declaring up front some sort of value capture tax mechanism is that the speculation starts, money starts moving around, and it becomes very, very hard to introduce tax changes down the track. I just can't understand for the life of me why council officers and councillors themselves haven't actively spoken about some sort of value capture tax to take a very large part of this windfall gain off the table to plough into community infrastructure. It's utterly against a stated state government policy. Indeed, if you look at, say, Councillor Sarah Mansfield, who is only there on council because she's supported by the Greens, it's stated Greens policy that these types of windfall gains are taxed at 75 cents in the dollar. She didn't say a word on the night that this decision was made. None of the other councillors from the north, whether that be Anthony Aitken or Carly Kreisbeck, also stood up and wanted to seek some sort of value capture tax mechanism to try to fund all of the infrastructure the north requires. A $2 billion windfall, and it all goes at this stage to the lucky landowners and rent seekers running around in that area. Brilliant for them, but a shocking outcome for our community. Just utter madness. As I said, totally against stated government policy. Yes, councillors themselves can't initiate some sort of what we call a growth areas infrastructure contribution or VCT, but at least step up as a policy position and say, here we are about to announce these area framework plans, but we're not going to do so and put them on exhibition until the state government steps up. In this case, where is John Aaron in all of this? Here he is as the state Labor member for the North for, what's his particular
Lara.
Seat? Lara. Where was his voice in talking to all of these things? Yes, he's not part of council itself, but he's still the leading state government member for the North. And where's his action to try to procure some of this windfall gain and ensure that money, substantial parts of that money, come back into the North to fund the community infrastructure, first and foremost the Northern Arc?
Well, a conversation coming up about infrastructure in the North very shortly. Just last of all on parking, first of all, the council's had this parking survey out there and they've decided ahead of time to come in and make this decision about free parking in the CBD. From what I can understand, is that because Eddie Contell decided to rush this through as an urgent motion, wanting action immediately, that they make parking free? And also the second element of it is that they've announced it for free 30-minute parking, which is not quite what a lot of people were expecting. When the front of the paper says free parking in the CBD, I don't think of that as being 30-minute parking and then back to the usual rates after that.
Well, looking at the council papers for that particular session, it certainly seems that Eddie Contell put it up as a special councillor motion of some sort. I don't quite understand how the system works, but he's got this motion up. And quite frankly, six populist children on one side of council have supported it, and the five adults in the room haven't. And this includes the mayor and the deputy mayor. So basically, a majority of their fellow councillors have gone against the mayor and the deputy mayor and three other adults, and the populist children have won the day. Now, how contemptuous to the people of the city of Greater Geelong and the officers who ran a very substantial, expensive survey to try to ask the people what they thought and to try to move through some sort of intelligent discussion on how best to manage CBD parking. Instead, these six councillors, obviously supported by or pushed by Eddie Contell, have come up and supported a motion to make free car parking available for 30 minutes. Weeks before the analysis of the survey has been compiled and released for some sort of intelligent public discussion. I just think it's so contemptuous of the people of the City of Greater Geelong. I think it's an appalling outcome. Tens of thousands of dollars have been spent on this survey. I've had a similar experience with council where they asked me to conduct a consultation with a developer community feeding into the land settlement strategy. They ignored all of our work as well and predated it, their supply numbers before that consultation took place. So I've got some personal experience with the way council has conducted these surveys and the way they've treated the people. I think it's not necessarily the council officers that have done this, but six councillors have. I think it's disgraceful.
To be fair, Eddie Contell has pushed for this for a very long time, the free parking. It was one of the main planks in his election campaign last time around. That said, the other councillors probably should have said, well, let's just wait and see what happens with this public survey first, because you've got to put out there that you're at least trying to listen to the people.
Of course. If you're going to run a survey and you want to run surveys in the future and expect the community to come on board with you, then do justice to the survey you've just pushed and spent a large amount of money on. Yes, I understand Eddie's position. Yes, he's pushed it. Good luck to him. He's more than entitled to that particular opinion. But for goodness sake, listen to what he's got to say. Wait. Analyse the results of the survey. Put it up for public discussion and then make a decision. And the other thing is, I just don't think 30 minutes is long enough to make a definitive change of people behaviour. And the other thing is, what's in it for council? The trouble is, council don't share in the revenue from land tax or stamp duty. So, for example, if you offer free car parking, you create and become a catalyst for further business activity, great for the retailers, but how does council get back the revenue that is otherwise lost by virtue of $2 million being scrubbed, say, for this 30-minute trial? I just don't think there's a necessary offset. So I think there's some problems in the way council is funded. I think it needs to share in particular property taxes in an arrangement with the state government, so it's got a growth tax that it can rely upon, not just the occasional grant and not just rates that has to constantly go back to its poor ratepayers to fund.
One thing that might help a bit is apparently they're moving more towards app-based technology for their parking, they said. That was part of the arrangement, and I just wonder if that might help with their compliance of parking enforcement. Maybe they can recoup more money through fines. I'm not sure if that even comes close to $2 million, but that could be on the agenda.
But you don't want to run this entire campaign on the back of more fines.
No.
You're trying to get people to come in. If they get fined, there's a more aggressive approach to fining people. They're in for the first 30 minutes, but bang, we're going to grab them at 35 minutes or 45 minutes. You know, I think you might do more damage than good in that process. We have spoken about smart meters in the past, Mitchell. There's meant to be all the sensors in the ground throughout the CBD parking. I've talked about reverse surge pricing, whereby you can encourage people to come in off-peak times and get free parking through that particular process. That, I think, is a much more nuanced, sophisticated way of trying to encourage people to come in and make better utilisation of our car parking. But simply 30 minutes of free car parking, I can't see it. But maybe Eddie's right. I don't know. But for goodness sake, listen to the results of the survey. Actually analyse it. Work with your experts, your council officers, and then come out with a considered responsive plan to that survey.
Tom, we'll have to leave it there because the United Australia Party candidate for Corio is in the building, and I'm very keen to speak to him about what his vision is for the upcoming election. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mitchell.
Let's catch up
soon.
Look
forward to next time.
Thank you, Tom Rowe there.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye. Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.